Welcome to week 8. So, this week we're going to start off talking about the idea of non-compliance, which is really closely related to the idea of instrumental variables. And so you'll see me sort of like move back and forth between these ideas. This is a real sort of like warm up to one of the more powerful ideas inside of observational studies, which is to find an instrumental variable out there in the real world that will help you randomize things. So that's what we're warming up to today. But today we're going to spend most of the time talking about prospective randomized trial designs. And then next week, we'll talk a bit more about how these materialize, how they sort of like look like in the real world. Cool. So let's talk about a study that I've been doing here at Stanford for a little while. Tell you a bit about it and how it came about. This has to do with some of the gender-based violence prevention work that I've been doing. So if you scroll through the slides, you can see some pictures of the work that we've been doing in Kenya, where we've been teaching a classroom-based sexual assault program. And what we've been doing, if you get to slide 12, is thinking about some theoretical model where we've got some baseline covariates X, we've got some pathway variables P1 through P4, and then we have some outcome. And we had some conjectures about, oh, maybe this pathway is more important than that pathway, that kind of stuff. And we've been working to align the intervention such that we put most of the energies into the pathway variables that we think are the most important. So that's what a lot of my thinking's been over the past few years as we really tried to get this sexual assault, gender-based violence prevention program to really function, fire on all cylinders. So that's what I'm talking about up on like slide 13 now. In the past couple of years, sort of out of nowhere, if you scroll down slowly to slide 2021, this other program known as Flip the Script or EAAA came out essentially out of nowhere for me. And it looked a lot like what we were doing. It was a program, slide 21, that was written up in the New England Journal, where they were also able to show that they were able to bring down the rates of rape by half. This was different than what we had previously seen different than our work because it was with college-age women in Canada. So just a very different substrate, like cultural differences, developmental differences in the people that we were working with, that kind of stuff. So it was very exciting. And so when we saw that, we started unpacking a bit of what they were doing versus what we were doing. So if you go down to slide 28, we have these four pathway variables that we had been conjecturing were really useful. Turns out that Flip the Script EAAA had had very similar kinds of pathways that map almost one-to-one, but they had taken their program in a little bit of a different direction, whereas we spent a lot of time working on empowerment. They spent a lot more time working on the verbal skills. We spent a bit more time on physical defense, and they spent less time on physical defense. So it was really interesting to see that all happen. So we got very excited because it was a program that had been really tailored for people like on campus here, right? So over the past 3 years, we've been working with people on campus to bring this this EAAA program. So if you slide 37, so we work with the Sexual Assault Prevention, Sexual Assault and Relationship Abuse Office here on campus, the SARA office. We worked directly with the provost, spent a lot of time working with student advocates, the Greek system to get their buy-in and make sure that they felt really comfortable, work with a lot of the women in the program, so like women in engineering, women in business, like that kind of stuff, started building relationships there. And then over the last year, we trained up some graduate students to deploy the program. We launched last spring, and we did it sort of like quietly trying to get enrollment, but also really doing some stuff about how does this program work? Does it tailor well? And that's what I'm going to really focus in on today. So we brought this new program to Stanford. It was not as much of a jump from the Kenya slums to Stanford because we actually took a version of the program that had been tailored and thought out and used a lot of the same theories, but had been really worked out in college age. But still, Stanford's its own unique campus. Canada's slightly different. There are just lots of little, not even little, there's a lot of places for these interventions, especially these behavior interventions, to start going poorly, right? So reworking on logistics, recruitment strategies. Also, you can think about like how programs like this may not be socially acceptable here. There might be things about like how people think about genders, gender relations. Think about like, is this placing too much of a burden on a population that's already being victimized, right? Like, there's real, you know, like issues you might encounter here that you might not encounter in other other places where you might deploy these kinds of programs. So I'm going to tell you a bit about like how we've been thinking and testing and sort of evaluating that. And that's to do this pilot study. Let's go down to slide 42. So I'm going to simplify things a lot, and we didn't actually end up running this all the way, but I'm just going to keep it simple, so deliver the idea. So we got email addresses for all of the undergrads, and in particular the undergrads who had marked female on their Stanford profile. We also got information about which dorm they're in, what major, class year, that kind of stuff, and randomly sampled 200 people and assigned 100 to get the active recruitment, where we're really reaching out to them, trying to get them to sign up and take the program, and then 100 people to sort of passively monitor. And so scroll down to slide 48. You'll see the idea is we recruited 200 people into the randomization, flipped a coin, and half of them are actively recruited. That means we're asking them to take the intervention, and then they get to decide whether they take the intervention or not. That's what that top row is all about. And if you slide down to 51, same idea. We recruit 200 people. We randomize, so 200 people are assigned to the to be passively recruited. They get to decide, and we're hoping that they don't take the intervention. And then if you go down to slide 52, you can see people have free will. Right? We flip the coin. That's our randomization. That's that Z. This is again on slide 52. They get to make, they're in charge of their own dose selection. They can either take the class or they don't take the class. And similarly, but on the other branch, they have the same choice, but we're hoping that if we don't actively encourage them to take the intervention, then they won't, they're less likely to take it. So usually if you see like a randomized trial, there's just that first branch. We randomize, and then they either take the intervention or they don't take it. And you can design interventions where they literally can't take the treatment. We have control of the drug. There's no way to get the drug except for if we give it to them. But oftentimes in the real world, you get this kind of pattern that you're seeing here on slide 52, where we try to randomize, but then people non-comply. People break off of the assignment and do something else. And you know, on the top branch, especially with the behavioral program, you could think like, well, people are too busy, or people aren't ready for the class emotionally, or they don't see it's useful to them, or you know, something along those lines. So we want to allow people to be able to break off. On the bottom arm, you know, if we're not telling people about it, and someone takes the class, you can imagine that person's kind of different, right? Like that person probably goes out of her way to find these kinds of programs. Is very motivated, thinks a lot about sexual assault and that kind of stuff. So that kind of person who is non-compliant with the randomization is interesting, and for a lot of different reasons. So for us, we want to be able to understand who is going to decline taking it when they're made aware of it, and who's going to seek it out even if we don't tell them about it. Because that gives us a sense of the composition, the attitudes about these kinds of programs here at Stanford. So what am I saying? This kind of study design, which is known as an encouragement design, where we're trying to nudge people to take something, nudge them not to, what it does is it gives you an opportunity to understand, well, what's the difference between the intervention and the non-intervention? It's going to be hard though, right? Because there's this non-compliance. So it's not like perfect. Usually when we do these, we have very tight, everybody has this treatment and all the other people don't have it, right? So we're allowing some non-compliance. But this kind of study design allows you to identify people who are non-compliant and then follow up with that. So what am I saying here is like, these kinds of study designs help you understand a little bit of the efficacy. Does the intervention work? But then how do people respond either positively or negatively to the idea of actually engaging in the intervention? So these study designs, these encouragement designs, help you decouple compliance rates and the effect of the intervention. So I'll return to this again later. So I'm going to point you to a couple papers here. This is on slide 53. Probably one of the most major breakthroughs in understanding instrumental variables was the Angris-Ibbins-Rubin paper from 1996. It really cleared the air about like how to think about instruments. Before that, they were kind of mathematical, theoretical, I feel like, and there was a lot of sort of like sloppiness to them. This paper laid out and identified and unpacked a couple additional assumptions that people had been missing, and they did a really nice job of giving language. And I'm going to heavily use that language later in the lecture today to talk about and make it meaningful. And then I've got a tutorial with some of my colleagues on instrumental variables that lays out a lot of different ways to think about them. Also lays out some examples of instrumental variables. I think it's in section 3 in the paper, so that's kind of useful. Okay, so slide 54. I am switching a little bit to thinking of this as a randomized control trial. Let's describe this as a randomized control trial. So first thing is Z is our randomizer, our instrument, our treatment assignment. D is what people are going to take, and then we can look at Y, the outcome. So one of the issues, if you scroll down to slide 57, is if you start running a randomized trial and you did not mean to have this non-compliance, like, how do you analyze this? When we teach you basic statistics, we say we randomize someone into treatment, randomize someone under control, and then we just pretend, we skip over the idea that they could decide not to do that. They could become non-compliant. So this picture in 57, one way that people have decided, and this has totally fallen out of vogue, this is not acceptable anymore, to deal with this is to just ignore the people who were non-compliant. So I told you to take the treatment, I'll pay attention only to the people who took the treatment, and I won't pay attention and include in my analysis the people who, even though I told them to, they didn't, and I'll just ignore those. So these are the people who were in line or per protocol. And this, usually the lore, though this doesn't have to be true, the sort of like, you know, the tale that we tell each other is that the people who are non-compliant are the people who know better about what they should be taking. So the people who, maybe this is a drug trial here on slide 57, and we told them to take the treatment, they start having a negative reaction, you know, they start vomiting or something like that. And so they branch off and they take like some other, you know, they take the control level. And that's probably correct. That's a good idea, you know, to do that in terms of the clinical practice. But the issue, if we as analysts are going to analyze that, is that if we allow those people who branched off because they have negative reactions to the treatment, if they disappear from our data set, then we're censoring some of the data, and these people are going to, like, now our estimate's going to be overly inflated because of the people who pulled out of the treatment were having negative responses, and we're not going to see those negative responses because they pulled out. So under a per protocol, the treatment looks better, and the control, you know, tends to look, you know, like kind of like worse. So per protocols, people think of them, though it doesn't have to be, that they overly inflate the benefit of the intervention relative to the control. The other option here is if you scroll down to slide 62 is the intent to treat. So the intent to treat is nicer. It's where people have kind of settled on. Like, I'm going to push it a bit further and start teaching you about like instrumental variable versions of this. But in the sort of like FDA rule book, the default way of analyzing a trial of non-compliance is to an intent to treat. And that says, if you randomize to take the treatment, then you should analyze them regardless of what they actually took as having been taken the treatment. And if you put them, randomize them to the control, you pretend like they definitely took the control and you analyze it that way. This is not insane, okay? And the reason that it's not insane at all is you just have to switch how you think about what's being produced here. The estimate that we're going after here is not the effect of the intervention. We're not isolating it down there because we have non-compliance. So the intent tree is really a mixture of what's the benefit of the intervention, the benefit of the intervention, and then how many people are sort of like dropping out of it. If you have really high rates of compliance, non-compliance, then, you know, the drug maybe not sort of like effective, right? So let me try to say this a different way. Is what's being analyzed here in intent tree is like a policy level causal effect. If I tell doctors to always, you know, to try to give people this treatment and the rates of non-compliance with it stay the same, then this is the effect of this policy of initiating this drug versus the what we've been using as our standard of care. That big assumption, there's a big assumption there, which is that like if you were to run this trial, that and the rates of non-compliance in this trial will be similar to the rates of non-compliance out there in the real world after the trial. I mean, that's a fairly hefty assumption, but it does kind of like maybe more felicitously track what might happen under a policy. So just to say one more time, this trial goes after the idea of like encouraging people or initiating trying to get people to take the treatment, but acknowledging that there's some benefit to the treatment, but maybe people won't be compliant with it. That's kind of like the what's going on here. And that's in contrast to the way we usually think of a randomized trial, which is to say, this is the effect of the intervention versus the control if everybody had the treatment and versus everybody had the control. Right? There's no story there. It's simpler about like non-compliance. So, cool. Just to really drive this home, a per protocol is a... Actually, let's stay on slide 62. So I've written it out here. The intent tree is we look at the outcomes for people who were assigned to the treatment. And then this notation here is really important. It's very subtle. I'm going to contrast it in just in the next slide. But for people who, whatever dose they actually take, right, this D sub I of 1 says you were randomly assigned to get the treatment, but then your dose is unspecified here. It just is DI. You get to do whatever you want. And then we contrast that, or we difference that with the outcome for people who were assigned to the control. But then again, you see the same notation, and it'll be contrasted in just a second, so you can see the difference here. Is this D sub I of 0. So you were randomly assigned to get the control, but your dose, the thing you actually take, is unconstrained. You can do whatever you want. So this is the intent to treat. This is the base unit of the intent to treat. This is how we're thinking. We'll average this across a bunch of people to get like the average, intent to treat expected value. So if you scroll down to slide 65, the per protocol, and I really try to highlight here this at the bottom of slide 65, is it's almost the same thing except for you see those red values that I put in there. So D sub I of 1, and then the per protocol says, and you had to actually take the treatment. So that's the difference in the condition. I tried to draw that out earlier for you. That's what the pictures above there are showing. Cool. So intent to treat's the right way to go, but we can maybe do better. We can maybe think about, from a trial design that has non-compliance, can we get an estimate that looks more closely, more specifically at what's the effect just of the intervention, not some compositional effect of the intervention and non-compliance? And in order to do that, I'm going to start talking about instrumental variables and the ways of thinking about their behavior. So scroll down to slide 77. You'll probably recognize this from a couple weeks back, where there are different target estimates. So there's the causal effect of the treatment, which is the individual person I, and thinking about like, well, what would happen for that particular person if we move them from taking the treatment to moving to the taking the control? And we can't get that because that's an individual person. That's the fundamental problem of causality. So maybe we talk about the average treatment effect, or we talk about the effect of the treatment on the treated, treatment effect on the control. We've talked about all those. Now we're going to talk about the effect of the intervention on a subgroup, which is the compliers. So there's a group inside of our analyses that stuck to the randomization, and I'll describe this in the next couple of slides, who we can, even if there's non-compliance, they behave as if they were in a fully randomized trial, and we can do some, under some assumptions, some fairly hefty assumptions, we can estimate their impact, how much they were impacted by the intervention. Cool. We won't be able to estimate for other people. One of the weirdest things that I want to drive home is, you know, if you're scrolling through the slides 85 and the 80s, you know, these are slides that you saw earlier when I was trying to help you understand who was a, you know, who did the average treatment effect try to estimate for, who did the average effect of the treatment on the treated, who did the average effect of the treatment on control, who were the, what are these estimands talking about? Well, they're talking about different kinds of people, either everybody in our population or just the people who are currently taking treatment or just the people who are currently taking the control. If you get down to slide 94, the issue here that I'm really trying to drive home is that, and I'll try to drive this home on a couple different slides, is the compliers in an instrumental variable analysis, we are estimating the effect on a group called the compliers, which I haven't really defined yet. But one of the weirdest things about it is that the compliers, you can't actually see them. You won't be able to point to anybody in your study and say, this person is a complier. You'll have some sense of some people who what their compliance class is. Maybe they're an always taker, a never taker. And again, I'll define these in just a minute. You'll see some pictures. But that's a little bit frustrating and a little bit weird, and it should make you uncomfortable about what's going on with an instrumental variable analysis. Okay. And I'll return to that in a little bit. Okay, so let's draw some pictures to give you a sense of what's going on with the instrumental variable. So here is that, I've switched the notation a little bit. I've now got responses rather than outcomes, so R's instead of Y's, but same idea. If you scroll down to 96, this is the behavior of a complier. So a complier, if you flip a coin, tell them to take the treatment, and then they do in fact take the treatment, but if we had flipped the coin, it'd come up tails, we told them to take the control, they would have taken the control. So I'm trying to be careful with my language because I'm trying to use this kind of like counterfactual statements. So in order for someone to be a complier, you need to know what they would have done on both branches, under both randomizations. And the idea of a complier is like on slide 96, they would do what you tell them. They would comply with the randomization. So these people are implicitly, we've always assumed, you know, in the previous randomized trial classes that you've had, mostly we've just assumed everybody's a complier. But that's not always true, right? So if you go to 97, you have always takers, which are people who, regardless of what you randomize them to, they will end up taking the treatment. And so maybe we're doing something like your treatment is trying to get people to exercise. And some people it takes motivation and they would in fact start exercising more if you really, really encourage them, offered them incentives. But other people, even if you tell them not to exercise, they're going to sneak it in, right? That's just what they like. So that's that person would be an always taker. It doesn't matter what you tell them to do. They're going to take the intervention. And then the other type of person that's kind of similar spiritually, but just the mirror opposite is whatever you tell them, they're not going to take the treatment. Right. So this might be like, you know, you can think about like, someone who would never exercise or something like that, but also maybe like, you know, drug trials. This happens where someone is allergic to the intervention, but they're not allergic to the control level. So that kind of person, as soon as you identify that they're allergic, they're going to branch off and not take the intervention. So that might be like that would be a never taker. Depending on how exactly you're running your study. Then there's just also this other kind of person, conceivably in this binary treatment setting called the defier, where if you tell them to take one level, they'll take the opposite. And we usually assume, like you'll see on slide 100, that this person doesn't exist in general. You know, it's usually motivated by their experience with the intervention, that they either take it or don't. But this compliance class, this defier, is a very interesting compliance class, which is to say that they are enrolling in your study or they're behaving in this study in a way that they're going to bounce in exactly the opposite direction. This totally can happen, right? Like I like referring to this as like a teenager, right? It's going to do the exact opposite of what mom and dad tell him. David Rugosa likes using a Simpsons like the TV show analogy, where the complier is Lisa, the always taker is the never taker is Homer, the always taker is Lisa, the complier is Marge, and then the important part is that Bart is the defier. So he liked making that analogy. In a more practical setting, sometimes what we use as an instrument, as a randomizer, is the distance to a treating facility. So you've seen me use this a couple times with a premature baby. If a mom lives really close to a high-level NICU, she's going to go there. If she really lives close to a low-level NICU, she'll deliver there. That holds in a lot of types of care, clinical care, but one place it doesn't tend to hold is like in mental health. So in mental health, people, especially like drug abuse clinics or like severe, residential kinds of programs, serious kinds of interventions, people tend to go to further away facilities. So instead of it being an encouragement based on proximity and like you're more likely to go here, it's sometimes based on proximity, but it works in the exact opposite way. So, what I'm saying, I guess, is like if you thought of your randomizer as for all different types of clinical care, you could get some people who, like the premature babies, are your instrument based on proximity would be, you would have some compliers. But then if you also included sort of sloppily, you would also include like mental health in there, then you would also have some defiers. Usually the defiers can be reasonably dealt with because you can think carefully about how the instrument works and who it's working for or not and why people are behaving in a certain way. And you can sort of carve out your study such that it's unlikely to have defiers. It is a challenge, and I'll return to it talking about it in a little bit. On slide 106, I guess I already covered this earlier, but the idea is that we were really actively recruiting on one arm. We randomized people to like get outreach emails, to have several of them, to have people go to certain sessions and really try to recruit them and get like more and more people to take the class. And the other one, we just sort of were passively monitoring. This is really important because two things happen here. And I guess I said this a little bit before, but I didn't really drive this home, is we can, if we randomize in this way, for the people who are compliers, we can see how much does the sexual assault prevention program help. And it won't be a great estimate, right? Because of the non-compliance, you're sort of getting lower rates proportionally. If you allow non-compliance, you're starting to get fewer people participating in your study because there's a lot of never takers and always takers and that kind of stuff. And so you're reducing your sample size. So that's a real issue. There's also that issue of not knowing exactly who your compliers are. So there's some instability or unknownness going into your estimate there. But let me give you the positive reason for doing something like this is you see someone who we randomize to have that active recruitment, but then they branch off and don't take it. I can see who that person is, like literally in the real world. Like I can figure out a name. And what we did is we followed up with them and we talked to them. We can understand and unpack why did they not, why did they not take it? And that's super interesting to us. That's actually like part of our research agenda, is to think about the barriers to taking the class. For ours, it's the kind of stuff you might anticipate, which is like, oh man, I am a Stanford student, so I'm super busy. The other thing is like, well, I'm not really at risk. I live a pretty quiet life and I don't, right? And so as with most prevention programs, the barriers are like, what's the value proposition? I don't see myself at risk, even though I do have some risk. Once we started seeing that, wasn't terribly surprising, but we modified some of our language in the recruitment to be less about like, hey, let's take your rate of safety down. That's the way we sort of originally were pitching it. And being more like, if you learn these skills, you could probably help the people around you as well. So motivating, there's a couple different things going on there about like, what are some of the behavioral motivations? But what we did was we understood some of the non-compliance, the quote unquote never takers who were popping out. And we could then like think about how to improve our outreach, try to get more people in there. And similarly on the other branch, the people who were, assigned to not get active recruitment, but then showed up at our classes, we talked to them as well. What was motivating them? How did they see this? Were they from different kinds of communities? And it turns out they were. These were, like you might have guessed, people who were very interested in sexual assault prevention, had, you know, traveled in circles that thought about it a lot, and were really willing to recruit themselves, you know, to other people around them. They came from a certain subset of people at Stanford, which is super good to know. And then we modified how they could reach out to their own communities. But we really, really recognized that, like, the people who were being modified by our outreach was very much a subset. And then we figured out what were some of the barriers and tried to communicate in a different way. Our active recruitment could be modified to get better rates of compliance. So it's all kind of a little bit like all over the place. But the point is, sometimes when you do a, you know, like a randomized trial, especially early on, you're trying to get a sense of, is the intervention working? But you're also trying to think about, like, especially with humans involved, why are they not taking it? Why are they taking it? What are the barriers to uptake? And this study design, this encouragement design, is really useful because you can follow up in a mixed methods, like qualitative, you know, deep interviews. And that will help you do a better job later on. Okay, so this is what I've been advertising, but I haven't really done yet, which is to tell you about how can you analyze these data in order to get a causal effect. So that's what we're going to dig into for the second half of lecture. So the intent to treat SMN, I was showing you just a little bit ago, talked through it, but in English, so we're on slide 111 right now, it's the difference in outcome when a person has his or her treatment assignment or randomization set to Z, but they can actually take D. So there's no fix, like we're just saying, let's analyze the data relative to the randomization. We randomized people to treatment, randomized people to control, they got to actually take whatever they want. Let's use the instrument, or sorry, let's use the randomizer, use the, which is an instrument, that Z, as a pivot, so we can get an unbiased estimate of that target estimate, which is the intent to treat. The ITT is an averaging over the effect of the treatment for the for the compliers and the outcomes of the non-compliers. And yeah, like I said, it's sort of viewed as being biased towards the null. Going to slide 113. The reason that we're like not super excited about the intent to treat is that we're probably more interested in something like this, which is the causal effect on an individual person, which is, I literally have the treatment, I literally don't have the treatment, what would be my difference? And that's not really what's going on in the intent to treat. It's this mixture of like people branching off, and like I said, like the always takers always take this, so that we would never really get to see what their outcomes are on the control. So that's kind of like a disappointing feature of this intent to treat. Okay, so the intent to treat, I think you can probably see it's fairly simple to analyze. We told someone to take the treatment, we look at those, all the people we told to take the treatment, analyze, you know, average their outcomes, and then difference those from the control group where we see every, or the, not the control group, but the people who were assigned to the control group, analyze their outcomes, and look at differences in those two groups. So only matters in the intent to treat what the researcher assigned them to. I'm going to need a couple of assumptions that I'm going to go through before we can turn the intent to treat into the instrumental variable estimate, so the complier average causal effect. So the intent to treat is close to what we want, but it has rates of non-compliance mixed in. That sort of probably biases our estimate a little bit towards the null. So what we're going to do is start with the intent to treat. We're going to have to, and I'll talk through these assumptions now, but we'll adjust the intent to treat and we'll get something back that is more directly causal and located on the difference of the intervention. Okay, assumption one is the one that we always use, which is in causal and almost always in causal inference, which is the stable unit treatment value assumption, SUDVA. And that basically says, we've seen this a couple times now in lecture, but like my treatment that I take only impacts my outcome, it doesn't impact your outcome. And the treatment that you get doesn't impact my outcome. And this can be definitely violated. So I'm looking at slide 117 right now. So, let me scroll down. I think I actually talked about it here, yeah. Slide 122. Is SUDVA usually the way you like justify this assumption or defend it is like, well, I'm doing a surgery. This surgery only impacts me. It's not going to impact the other person in my study. But like it kind of like falls apart in cases with like, you know, COVID, infectious disease, where if I get the immunization, if I get the vaccine, I'm less likely to get the outcome. And because my outcome is less likely to occur, like I'm less likely to be infected, I'm therefore less likely to infect you. So my treatment status impacts the probability that you'll have the outcome. It's super true, and I worry about it a lot in my stuff because I'm usually interested in behaviors and behavior change. So whenever I teach someone an intervention, they can take that intervention, they take those set of skills and give it to someone else. So their treatment changes someone else's treatment. So there are different kinds of ways that the sutva can fail. But importantly, is we only need to know my intervention level in order to know my outcome. I don't need to know your intervention level to know your outcome. Did I say that right? So my intervention, my outcome, don't need to know your intervention to know my outcome. There we go. Assumption two is that the assignment is random. So this is saying for all different types of treatment levels, they're equally likely. So me being on the treatment, me being on the control, equally likely. There's no sort of unobserved variables that are confounding it. And this allows us to think of Z, the instrument, the randomizer, as being random, and therefore it's a pivot, and then we can get a unbiased estimate, or an estimate that's not conditional on any of the other nuisance parameters. It allows us to do things like use the IT to get the ITT by just looking at the average outcome for people who are treated divided by the average outcome for the people who are on the control. That's what's going on in slide 128. So this assumption is the most important, and it's super bummer because like it's the hardest one to defend. So in order to know that the Z is behaving like it's kind of like random, it's hard because you don't know in an observational setting that the other realizations were equally likely. The other ways that people could have been either, like in the baby example, close to the high level or close to the low level, you don't know if that's actually true. You don't understand like how people necessarily, you can't perfectly understand how people were definitely getting these other versions, could have gotten the other versions of the instrument. In an encouragement design, the one that we did here at Stanford where we were randomizing people to either have the active outreach or not, that actually is true. We can totally justify it by construction. I was the researcher. I put it through R, like, you know, there was a pseudo random number generator that behaves in a way that allows for Z to behave in this way. So so justifying that the instrument or the randomizer is in fact random is easy if you're doing this as a prospective encouragement design. In an observational setting, this is the one that's going to be really like challenging. You can check for some compatibilities with this assumption. And I'll talk more about this next week when we start talking about instrumental variables in observational studies more directly. But there's like four or five different things that you can say like, oh, well, I can't tell you perfectly that this definitely behaves as a randomizer in the real world. I can see that it doesn't fail in this way. It's like everything I see from the data is consistent with that assumption. And so the logic isn't perfect, right? It doesn't say, yes, we have confirmed this. It just says, when I look at it this way, no problem. When I look at it that way, no problem. When I look at, right? So it doesn't say that there won't be ever a problem. It really is doing the thing we want. We keep checking all these different ways and say, oh, it doesn't look like it's wrong. So I'll show you those kinds of things next week. Assumption three is the exclusion restriction, which says, so the exclusion restriction says that the instrument doesn't impact the outcome except through its impact on the treatment. Right? So this is something like in the baby's example, maybe you know, where mom lives definitely changes where she's going to deliver. But maybe if we were thinking about the baby example, you know, in the cities, people live closer to high-level hospitals. In the country, people live closer to low-level hospitals. Let's just use that example, very simplified example. That may not be a problem nowadays, But if you think, like, roll back your brains to, like, Industrial Revolution time, you know, Manchester, England, the cities are super polluted and the countrysides are much cleaner. It could be the case that the instrument, like where you live, which does assign people to the treatment or control, also is impacting the health of the baby's outcome in ways that we're not perfectly aware of. That would be a violation of this. In our prospective randomized trial, like so here at Stanford, if by reaching out and actively encouraging someone to participate in a sexual assault prevention program, if what that did was it put someone in someone's head that like, oh, I should just be more aware of this issue, and that somehow helped her later on see, anticipate, and prevent a sexual assault just by the mere being made aware of that potential, that would be a problem. Because maybe the people we didn't outreach to, they weren't getting their brains perturbed in that way. They weren't sort of made ready for this. This is why, you know, in a prospective randomized trial, we spend a lot of time doing like placebos and sort of things that make sure that like double blind studies, so people can't really tell which arm of the trial they're on. The randomization into a level doesn't really make you think of, doesn't modify your outcome. So like, you know, the violation of this in a prospective randomized trial might be like if you were doing pain medications and you knew that you were on this fancy intervention and the person who gives it to you is like, holy cow, I'm so glad you're on this because it's really going to beat your pain down. Versus, you know, oh, I'm sorry, you're on the sugar pill arm of the trial, and that changes how you perceive your own pain, right? So the reason we do double blinds and that kind of stuff is to enforce an exclusion restriction. So this is kind of a fun one when you're doing an observational study to think about because the violations are really plentiful, and we'll talk about it again next week. Just to show you a picture, this is like probably my favorite kind of way to draw out an instrumental variable setup. You can scroll through here slowly to slide 148. So the issue is T, its impact on Y. That's the arrow we're interested in. What we're worried about is U, the variable, not the person listening to this. And U changes the outcome and changes the treatment. So that triangle there is the most problematic thing for us. And what we're doing, this Z is the instrumental variable. It's kind of like free from the bad stuff. It's, the economist calls exogenous. So on the right-hand side, that triangle is endogenous. That's the like sort of tangled nest of ugliness. And then the Z is coming in from the outside and it's changing T. But it isn't, and I really sort of emphasize this by drawing these X's on these other lines. Z is not connected to Y directly. That's the exclusion restriction, that upper area, upper line that's X'd out between Z and Y. That's the exclusion restriction. And then there's another assumption down here we'll talk about in just a second between Z and U. This is like the sort of directed acyclic graph. This is the path model. This is the way of visualizing an instrument. So let's talk about this example. So in 153, I guess I've already used this a little bit, but let's say we're studying a drug that might change someone's pain. And the issue is that if you were to just look at in a natural setting, in a sort of deployed setting, people who have high pain tolerance might need different levels of the drug. They might need higher, levels of the drug, but they may also be experiencing a lot more pain. So that unobserved variable, which may be their pain tolerance or like or something that's like hard to measure, that might be like imposing some understanding of the relationship between the drug's use and pain. But if we were to randomize people to either get the drug or not get the drug, or randomize people to different doses of the drug, that would allow us to recover a better job of what's going on, the connection between the drug level and the amount of pain. But again, like I mentioned a couple of slides ago, what we're worried about is if you tell someone that they are on an amazing new painkiller, just the mere suggestion of that might tell someone that they should experience less pain. And there's nothing that the brain doesn't do better than to control our perceptions and generate our perceptions. So just by being assigned to an arm, if you have a belief, that might directly change the outcome. If we were to not randomize, then we might put people into the drug levels based on their pain tolerance. But if we are generating the assignment mechanism in a way that doesn't take into account pain tolerance, then it will be orthogonal or random relative to pain tolerance. So that's why that bottom line is X'd out between Z and U, the U variable. Yeah. The other thing you know, in the real world, you might use like an instrument instead of like, if you don't have access to a randomizer, you might use like an instrument like, oh, this drug is available for cheap for these people because they're on this health plan, this insurance type, but this other insurance type has a different drug formulary, so they don't have access to that drug. So if you believe that people were roughly like randomly or sort of without a lot of information about what their pain tolerance is assigned to these different insurance plans, you might get some ability to think about recovering the effect of this particular drug's influence on pain management, that kind of thing. Cool. Slide 157. When you combine assumptions 1 through 3, what you can do is you can start recovering some sort of like a subset of people in our study, and you can start getting to their effects. But in order to do anything with that, you have to have assumption 4, which is there this subgroup that does have their intervention changed. So that's what's going on in slide 160. Let's go down to 160. Sorry, 167. So assumption 4 is that there, though I have the math there in the first bullet point, what it's saying is that there are compliers. There are people who, when you randomly assign someone a treatment, so that's what that D of 1, the 1 there is the Z is set to 1, so the people who are randomized to get the treatment, that there is some difference between, you know, the rates at which they take the treatment and versus the other people who are randomly assigned to take the control, there's some difference between the rates that they will take the treatment. So what are they saying here? It's like, there's some people who, when you go from Z is 0 to Z is 1, that they will change their dose. They'll change their dose. So this happens in a randomized trial if you're doing a good job of encouraging people to take the treatment, and your other branch is not, you know, is that sort of dissuading people from taking it. What we're hoping is that this quantity that is close to 1, if you actually have 1, that expected value is 1, then that's great. That's like a randomized trial that we've always been talking about, where when you randomize someone to take the treatment, they'll take it, and they'll take the control. But usually we'll see something somewhere between 0 and 1 in practice. Like I just ran a randomized trial, it was something closer to like 95. Something like that. When this quantity is low, we usually refer to this as like a low or a weak instrument. And those are really problematic for a number of different reasons. This assumption isn't too bad. You can actually just look at it directly. You can look at the correlation between D and Z. Like when you have someone who's encouraged to take the treatment, what's the rate that they take the D, take the dose? And when you have lower values of the instrument, do people are less likely to take the instrument? Scroll down slowly to slide 75. 174. So what's happening here is, I think you may already be able to have seen this, but like there are different kinds of people, compliers, always takers, never takers, that are gonna, as they move through our randomized trial, they're going to appear in these different buckets. So the compliance class, one of the assumptions that we have is that a compliance class for a person is fixed. Based on the encouragement, based on the instrument, based on the randomization, based on the study that we're participating in, I'm either a complier or I'm an always taker or I'm a never taker. I may not be able to usually in general tell who is who, but inside of this, and you can see this on slide 174, you can probably already eyeball it, there are a couple places where we can identify some people who are never takers and always takers, right? So in the upper branch, we tell someone to take the treatment, they take the treatment, those people are compliers and always takers. if on the upper branch, if we say take the treatment, but they don't take it, those people are never takers. So we can see some people and identify them that they are in fact never takers. On the upper branch, because it's compliers and always takers, I can't tell who is who. I can't tell someone is a complier or someone's an always taker, because in order to know who's who, I would have to switch them to the other branch and then see what their behavior is. On the lower branch, so control low, that's a complier and never takers. That bin of people there is a mixture of those two. But on the lower, so the control, and then they take the treatment, you see the always takers on that branch. Those people are definitely always takers. I don't need to see the other, you know, what they would have done on the other branch, because I know that this is a characteristic of them, that when we tell them not to take it, they'll take it. So what's going to go on here is, if you scroll down sort of slowly, is, let's go to slide 178. If we assume that we randomize 50-50 down both branches, and we observe that there are 30% of the people that we randomize to take the treatment who end up in the lower branch. So I'm on slide 178. See that 30% of everybody who was randomized to this arm is coming up in the never takers. You look on the other side, on the other branch, people who we randomized to the control, you see 20% of people branching off and taking the treatment. Well, these are what we observed. We can now take these values, that 30% for never takers, and take it as a stand-in on slide 180, on 180. Take that 30% that we saw of never takers here and say, oh, it's probably roughly 30% down here too, right? And that 20% for the always takers, we can sort of say, oh, it's probably 20% up there for them. And then we can sort of back into the fact that we must have like 50% compliers. So that's the kind of logic that we can use to, while we can't point to any particular person, we can say, oh, that's, you know, there's some mixture in here, in these two bins of compliers and always takers and compliers and never takers. While we can't say who's who, we know roughly that in the top one, 50% are compliers, 20% are always takers. We can estimate what the outcomes look like for always takers because we can see them directly in the lower branch, in the control, and then high. We can see what their outcomes are because we can just see them. And we know that that's 20%, and that's where we got that 20%. So we can reverse engineer. We can back these kinds of things out. In order to do this, we have to have assumption 5, which gets rid of the defiers, right? So that's, let's go down to, you can scroll through there slowly to slide 193. If we don't assume away the defiers, if we don't build our study such that there are no defiers in them, then this gets harder, right? Because now all four of the bins are compositionally complicated, and we can't find the people who are, a clean estimate, or sorry, a clean place to estimate what's going on with some of our compliance classes. I'm gonna say it's one more way, just to make sure I really drive this home, because this is really at the core of an instrument and why like instrumental variable analyses are kind of weird and hard. So 194, the definitions of an always taker, complier, defier, never taker hinge on things that we can't see. It's a compliance class. So we need to know on slide 194, if we assign someone to not take the treatment, what would they do? If we assign them to take the treatment, what would they do? So if you scroll down, like an always taker, you know, you can see has, you know, it will always take the treatment no matter which arm we put that down. So that person would always have that. The issue is, if you're looking, you know, let's scroll down to slide 198. If you look down the branch of where we put people into the treatment, there's a couple people who will look similar. Their response on that branch, the always takers and the compliers will realize they will have, and we will observe them taking the treatment. So we can't really tell them apart. That's the branch that we can see that when they're on. We can tell the never takers because they're the only group that isn't taking it because we've assumed away the defiers. Similarly, on the other branch, when we assign people to not take the treatment, you can see that the compliers and the never takers, they realize, they observe, they have the observed value of not taking the treatment. So we can't disentangle them because we would need to know for that particular person what would have happened on the other branch. So that's what's going on here. These compliance classes are unobserved. We can't see them directly. We can figure out in some settings, under some conditions, like who a group that, if you were randomized, is maybe a representative of what's going on for that compliance class. Cool. Let's scroll down to slide 202. If you give assumptions 1, 3, 4, and 5, then you can get the instrumental variable estimand. And that takes the observed value up top of what's the difference in the people who were assigned to the, in their outcomes for the people who were assigned to treatment and for the people who were assigned to the control. What's the expected value there? Divided by the quantity of, well, what's the change due to the instrument in the rates of people taking the treatment? That's probably the best way I can say it. If you scroll down slowly from 202 to 203, from 203 to 204, a better way to think about what's going on is what I did is I just took that quantity up above and changed it into other names. So what's going on there is the intent to treat, that's in the numerator, and then in the denominator is the percentage of people who are compliers. So what this is saying, the rough intuition is on slide 205, which is saying that the intent to treat, the amount of difference in the outcome that we see under the intent to treat, really comes exclusively from the compliers. The only people who are having their outcomes changed in a study with compliers and always takers and never takers are the people who are compliers. Because the always takers will always take the treatment and the never takers will never take the treatment. So their outcomes don't change due to the treatment. You never get to see that. So what we're essentially saying is all of the change in outcome is due exclusively in this study is due exclusively to the people who are compliers. They're the only ones who really participated in the randomized trial. So if they're 50% of the population, then we really only, even though the intent to treat thought we had 100% of the people in there, we really only had 50% of the people who were actually complying with the study. It's actually kind of, it's kind of nice. Like when the math all works out like this, it sort of feels nice, right? Like it's like, we start with the intent to treat. The intent to treat is some composition of the treatment effect and non-compliance. Well, let's just figure out how many people complied. Once we figure out how many people complied, we'll just adjust. Everybody else wasn't really having an outcome changed by the intervention. And slide 206 is just giving you a little bit of an intuition. Like, if you're thinking about setting up your study, one important step along the way is to really articulate, who do you think are going to be the always taker? Who do you think are going to be the compliers? Why is there no such thing as a defier? Can you set up your study so there's no such thing as a defier? And you know what's going on with the never takers? And you really want to set up your study better and better and better, more tight, design it such that there's a high level of compliers and very few always takers, never takers. And I'll return to that next week. Cool. And here's the last part of today's lecture, which is to talk about how to do inference in these settings. So historically, let's go down to 211. Historically, when I started learning this stuff, people only referred to two-stage least squares. And it was almost like two-stage least squares and instrumental variables were the same thing, which is not true. Probably right as I was graduating, so like 2009, 2010, a paper came out that introduced the idea of residual inclusion models. And that's probably where the state of the art is right now, and I'll tell you a bit about those in just a minute. Those are very closely related to two-stage least squares, but they do an amazing, it's a very small change for a huge payoff. And then I'll also talk about permutation-based inference because we developed a framework for that as well. Okay, so historically, let's scroll down to slide 215. Two-stage least squares, what it does, the two stages refer to two different models. One model is describing the selection in the treatment, and the second model is describing the behavior of the outcome, the response surface. So you probably want to scroll through this a little bit slowly, but let's go to slide 202. So selection of the treatment, that model says your dose, the intervention that you take, the exposure that you get is some function. That function is f of fd, which is the function of d, and it takes in your baseline covariates and your instrument value, And usually it's usual form that people implemented in is a least squares. So you have a additive linear model down below. And then you have a second model, which is a function of X, the baseline covariates, in D, which is the dose or the treatment that you're interested in. And that gives you the outcome. And again, maybe it's a linear model. It's got different coefficients, right? It's got different error terms, all that kind of stuff. So the story for two-stage least squares, if you go from 220 to 221, is first you fit that treatment model. You get beta hats, you get a D hat. Now go to 222. You fit the outcome model, but if you go to 223, the important part is you fit it using the substituted value, the estimated value that you got from your first model. So this D, this red D hat, that is what I would guess someone's intervention level is based on the model that I fit up above. So it's called a predictor substitution method. You don't use the actual observed value, you use something related to it. And this has a little bit of a problem. Predictor substitution models have like some fitting issues and that kind of stuff. Let me describe exactly what I mean by this. If you go down to 230, generally speaking, two-stage least squares has some issues when the outcomes are nonlinear. So two-stage least squares was designed for something where your intervention is something like maybe like years of education or the amount of money that we give someone in like a UI, UBI. And then we look at like income a year later or something like that. So those are two continuous quantities. It doesn't work well if the outcome is nonlinear. So if it's binary, a binary outcome, someone's going to live or die, that's where things really get messed up for the two-stage least squares. And that has to do with some ways that the projections in the space work. So let me try to say this in a cleaner way. You can do a two-stage least squares when you have a continuous treatment and a continuous outcome. It also turns out that you can do this, it's safe to do a two-stage least squares when you have a binary treatment and a continuous outcome. If the outcome starts being something weirder, very non-linear, now you're going to get into some real problems. So binary outcomes or categorical outcomes, stuff like that, is not really great for two-stage least squares, or Poisson, that kind of stuff can get really funky. So what people have done is, it's a very slight switch, is to move to a residual inclusion model. If you go down to slide 232, same idea. We're going to model the selection into the treatment, and then we're also going to model the outcome. So that feels very much the same. If you look at slide 233, let's just go to 234. The two-stage least squares, what it does is it substitutes the predicted value of the treatment into the outcome model. Let's go to 235. Instead of doing that, we're going to have this value E hat, which is a residual. It is, what do I believe the dose is, subtracted from what did I guess the dose is, and I'm going to have this like residual left over. And so on 236, this is the genius of, and this is the simplicity of, the residual inclusion model, is it says, instead of putting in an estimated or a predicted value of the treatment, let's do something more clever, which is to estimate the leftover of the treatment assignment. So the intuition here, and it works really well, is what we're modeling in slide 236, that red bit right there, that's the biased assignment. That is the part of the intervention, it's the residual, it's the part of the intervention that we could not estimate cleanly. So it is the contaminated, it is the biased part of the treatment assignment. And we're modeling it directly. So that alpha hat that's on the residual, that's pulling away it's pulling off the assignment mechanism, part of the assignment mechanism that is potentially contaminated by the unobserved baseline covariates, and it leaves a cleaner, quote unquote, cleaner version of the treatment to be estimated directly. That's what's going on there. There's also some much better math behind this, which is that it gives you like a nice Bayes functions, and instead of relying on the linearity features, you now have a proper basis to estimate under any GLM. Cool. Slide 240. Residual inclusion models were developed to deal with nonlinear outcomes. They perform super well under any of the GLMs. So logistic, Poisson, negative binomial, those are all sort of functional when you use a residual inclusion model. Those don't work very well. Those kinds of like general class of generalized linear models don't really work in the predictor substitution setting. So the takeaway from today is if you're going to use a model, you should really default to a residual inclusion model. And there's a whole bunch of nice packages that do this. You really do want to use a package here, because what I've suppressed along the way is there's some funkiness with the standard errors that are really important. And the software that's available, you don't want to hand calculate a residual inclusion model or hand calculate two-stage least squares, because the residuals that, or sorry, the standard errors that come out of them need to be adjusted appropriately. So the software is the right way to go. So instead of like going into detail on the permutation test today, I'll talk about it next week, but there's some nice technical references here if you want to read up before next week. But I'm going to talk next week about observational versions of instrumental variables, as well as like how to do it with a permutation-based test, because that's going to fit into the kinds of observational jujitsu that we like, which is a very spent a lot of time designing our study, getting to a study design that has a lot of compliers. We can really carefully describe why the instrument is working or failing. We're going to check those, but then we're going to do a very simple form of inference, this permutation-based inference, because then we can do sensitivity analyses, and we can show that we can get a stronger, more robust sensitivity analysis through some of our design choices. Great. We'll talk again next week. All the best.